Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, May 6th, 2026, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storchendi, naturopathic physician. Ron is outside working on the shed. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at FranSorchND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. So, on Tuesday, I had another epidural shot, and I was really nervous about it. Monday was a really nice day. I was feeling really anxious and I didn't know what was going to happen because the doctor told me that he had to give me conscious sedation and I wasn't looking forward to having conscious sedation. I really wanted to not have sedation, but he said you have to have it because you've had surgery. So once you've had surgery, apparently when you get an epidural pain medication shot, you have to have conscious sedation. Anyway, that's what Dr. Kashawi does. So that's what he said. So I went there, you know, thinking I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know if I'd feel dizzy or I'd feel bad afterwards, or if I'd be groggy for a day or what would happen. So with my shakiness and anxiety, I decided to go for a bike ride. And I went for a bike ride and I pounded some hills. I rode almost 11 miles. And I climbed over 900 feet. So that was 83 feet per mile. So it was a really hard bike ride. And I felt so much better afterwards. So I just want to point out there, I was feeling extremely anxious. I did some hard cardio. And when I was done, the anxiety had gone away. I slept pretty good. And the next morning, that calm that I got from riding the bike stayed with me. It was really good. As I was sitting with my friend Pat, who drove me to the appointment, when I was sitting in the waiting room, I was pretty calm and I was not freaking out on the way over. It was really amazing. Then I got in there and the nurse asked one more time for me. And I was also very delighted because the nurse that I had was the same nurse that greeted me for my surgery back in September. So I was very happy to see her. Her name is Taryn. She's just lovely. And anyway, so she asked Dr. Kashawi if I had to have the anesthesia. And he said, absolutely, you have to have it. All right, so that's the way it was going to go. So they got me set up, and Taryn had a little bit of issue getting my IV placed, but she did it, and so we had two tries, but I was fine with that. So she got my IV placed. It sat in my left hand, and I have some bruises. Anyway, and they're not terrible, but there's some faint bruises on both hands because they tried on both sides. So then once it was time, and I had to fast the night before. I had to fast from midnight, no food after midnight, and I could have clear liquids up until 8 a.m. because I wasn't due there until 12:45. And so they said I could drink clear liquids up until 8 o'clock. So as soon as I woke up in the morning, I started waking up around 6 a.m. Between 6 and 8 a.m., I pounded lots and lots of water with electrolytes in it and a little bit of natural Gatorade. And then at like 5 to 8, I had an 8-ounce glass of apple juice and for calories. And that was it. And then I didn't have anything. I might have taken a few sips of water, but that's it. And then I didn't have anything to eat until that time. And then they took me in. And they wheel you around the corner. And then there's the surgical suite. And they had me walk into the surgical suite. So I walked into the surgical suite and then they had me lay down on my tummy because they need access to my back. And I have a little cap. I have a cap and gown. So it's like you're graduating. I'm graduating from Payne University. Anyway, so I lay down on my tummy and then the anesthesia nurse says, okay, I'm going to give you some medicine to calm you down, to help you be calm. And I'm assuming she gave me the midazolam and then she went to give me something else. And it stung. They both stung going in. And my understanding was I would be under conscious sedation. And Dr. Kashawi said I would be able to talk with him during the procedure. I saw Dr. Kashawi for a minute in the bay before I was wheeled in. And he marked my back at the site where I was going to get the injection. And then I saw him sitting at the desk. And that's all I saw of him. Went in there, got those two injections. So she did the second injection, and the next thing I knew, I was sitting up talking to Taryn. So I don't know what happened. I don't know if I went to sleep or if I had amnesia, because one of the drugs I was given was midazolam. Midazolam is a benzodiazepine. Benzodiazepines work at GABA receptors. They are not GABA, and they're not exactly GABAergic. GABA is gamma-aminobutyric acid, which is a calming neurotransmitter, but they kind of work in that realm, and they can knock you out. So I guess I'm sensitive enough. So again, I don't know if I have amnesia or if I went to sleep. And it could have been either, because they gave me midazolam and they also gave me fentanyl. So they give you fentanyl when you have general anesthesia. Well, apparently they give you fentanyl when you have conscious sedation as well. I have no desire to go out and get an opioid for any reason. We have opioids in the house because we were given them after both of our surgeries. I have no interest in them whatsoever. I have cannabis too. Not using that either. And all these drugs, they make me feel weird and groggy and unpleasant. So, I mean, I had a couple of days where I took some, but I had to stop because I just don't feel great when I take them. I woke up and I was talking to Taryn, and somehow, I don't know if I had asked for it, but I had brought a refrigerated bag, you know, an insulated bag with an ice pack in it. And I had some electrolyte water and some natural Gatorade. And I had some food in it. I had a protein bar and I had a meat stick, and that was all in there. And it had been laid out for me. And I don't know if I had asked for it or if she knew it was there and she laid it out for me. And then I started to hiccup, and you can get hiccups from midazolam. So I had heard the other guy asking for that, being offered apple juice, cranberry juice, or ginger ale. So I asked for some ginger ale because ginger can calm hiccups. Did you know that? If you consume strong ginger when you have hiccups, especially if it's strong and you can taste it and it bites your tongue, ginger candy, ginger beer, ginger tea, it might not be enough to have ginger ale. But if that's what you got, that's what you got. So I drank the ginger ale and I think it calmed down. So anyway, that's what happened. And then I had no nausea or headache, or I didn't have a, an epidural headache, nothing like that. I felt fine. And when I was done, I got up and, you know, went to use the bathroom, and I was a little bit wobbly, and then that went away. And then I was fine. I was absolutely fine. And they had told me that not to exercise at all. I shouldn't even do gentle yoga. I shouldn't do any exercise of any kind that day. And then the next day, if I felt up to it, I was welcome to do whatever I liked. So the next day I decided I was not going to ride my bike. I was going to just do PT exercises and yoga, which is what I did. And I noticed right away, one of the things that happened was my back itself, it had been sore and felt tweaky and got pressure in it. That is much better. So far, so good. So the drugs that I had for pain were methylprednisolone and lidocaine. And then the other thing I had was Omnipaque. So I guess I'm not iodine allergic, because they use iodine contrast to see what they're doing, because they do this under fluoroscopy. They do have an ultrasound with fluoroscopy and they use iodine to see. So I did fine with all of those drugs, and I'm guessing they're not all out of me. I felt a little more chipper the last couple of days, and I wonder if the steroid is keeping me up. I had some insomnia the first night, and I did not have insomnia the next two nights, thank goodness. The insomnia, what I tried to do to get back to sleep was I tried to do deep breathing. I tried to do 4-7-8 breathing, breathe in for 4, hold for 7, and breathe out for 8. That wasn't working. And after 3 hours, I went into the kitchen and I had a calming glycerite that had a bunch of lovely herbs, and it had catnip and California poppy and passion flower and lemon balm and a couple other nervines. And I took a hit of that, and then I had some 100 milligrams of L-theanine. That L-theanine had a little bit of inositol and taurine in it as well. So I took those two things, and then I went to sleep, and that really helped. So just so you know, I had a nervine glycerite, not even a tincture. It was in glycerin, and I had a hit of that. There was lavender in it as well, and plus 100 milligrams of L-theanine, and that put me to sleep. So those are things, if you want to try those, if you have insomnia, and acute insomnia, it helped me go to sleep. Thank goodness. So, and then the next couple nights, I was okay to go to sleep. And so I'm finding that my back is better. The leg is a bit better. I still have numbness and tingling and pressure in my left leg, but it's improved. It's definitely improved. And they said, you know, the improvements can last, can happen over several days, and great improvements over several weeks. So we'll see if this holds. And my hope is if I have less pain, I'm going to be able to do more physical therapy and I'll get stronger. And once the muscles get stronger and hold my spine in place, I may not have as much pressure on the nerves. And we also hope that what he did was when he injected the methylprednisolone, it went into the spinal column, and any structures that were inflamed, it calmed those down. So if the herniated discs can recede back into their seats and stay there, then I'm less likely to have pain. I'm also hoping that, I know I have epidural fibrosis at the L4 thecal sac and also at the L4 nerve root. If there's inflammation there, maybe it will have calmed that down. But I'm definitely better. I'm not all better, but I feel like it was worth it. Today, now it's a couple days later, it's worth doing. They wanted me to come back for a follow-up, and I would have had to drive to Bloomfield, and he was available on my work days. So I said, how am I going to do that? I was able to come Wednesday last time. And she said, I know, but this month he's scheduled for Tuesdays for consults. And then she said, you can do a phone consult if you want. And we have May 12th for you if you want it. And then, so that actually worked out because I am not working that day. I'll be in Florida. So that's great. So I'm actually going to have my consult with him virtually by phone. And I'll be in Florida when he calls me. So that's really cool. So anyway, the big questions I have to ask him are, did I go to sleep or do I simply have amnesia? And if I simply have amnesia, was I awake and was I talking to him? And if so, what did I say? Was I weird? Did I sing a song? What happened? So, you know, I'm sure they've seen it all. And the nurses didn't say anything strange to me. I didn't see him afterwards, probably because I saw the tote board. You could see the tote board from the bay. He had a lot of people stacked up, a lot of, procedures that he had to do. So, I don't think it takes him that long to do any one procedure. That the actual time that he's in there giving me my injections, probably 10, 15 minutes. That's what it was when I saw Dr. Walker. It was done. Let me tell you, it is harder to get your teeth done, which I had done the next day. And I had to ask them, I'm supposed to have fillings and therefore carbocaine. Can I do that the next day? And they said to me, let your dentist decide and tell them what meds you've had and then ask her what if it's okay for you to have your teeth done. So I called Dr. Shvarek's office and she said, yep, come on in. You should be fine. And I was. Now I'm very excited because in a few days I will go back to Dr. Shvarek's for the rest of my fillings. And then I don't have any procedures for months and months. And so enough with the millions of doctor's appointments. It's such a relief. So I had so many dentist appointments. I had 5 eye appointments. And you know, we talk about as we get older, we have so many of these doctor's appointments that happen. But anyway, I'm wondering if the epidural shot will work better. It's an epidural steroid shot. It will work better because I had the surgery and there's more space in there so that the medicine can get where it needs to go to calm the nerve down, and I'll have less pressure and I'll be able to be more active. And, I'll maybe be able to lose some weight because I'll be able to be more active. And that'll be really good because my activity was limited because I still had a lot of pain and I didn't want to hurt myself. Although Dr. Lantner said I wouldn't hurt myself more. So I'm pretty psyched. The weather's getting nice. I want to get outside on my bike. We're supposed to go tomorrow. I think it's supposed to rain tomorrow, unfortunately. So I don't know if that's going to happen, but we'll see. Anyway, I'll get on either an indoor bike or an outdoor bike tomorrow. So that'll be nice. And then I'm going to up my game in terms of yoga and up my game in terms of oral care. And oh my goodness. So that's what's going on. And Ron is not here. He is outside working on the shed that he's building. And his hernia repair recovery is improving. He's getting less sore, but he still has soreness in his belly. And the scar is getting better. So there you go. All right. So I wanted to talk about a couple of other things. So, you know, we've heard all about, GLP-1s and GIP drugs are all the rage right now, of course. And one of the things that they do is they mellow food noise. So let's talk about food noise. Food noise is an interesting concept, and I kind of understand it. So what's food noise? It's more than a fleeting craving. It's a psychological tug of war that disrupts your relationship with food. Some people struggle with it for years, or some people have just noticed it. Some people think about food constantly, even when you're not physically hungry, and thoughts of your next meal might distract you at work or keep you up, and you could feel a lot of shame and guilt around the things that you eat. So it's a voice that doesn't seem to quit. Our brain and body are designed to signal hunger and satisfaction, but for some people, the mental conversation doesn't turn off, and the continuous food noise can convince someone to eat when they're not hungry, obsess over meals, and feel shame or guilt about your eating habits. So this obsessive kind of food-related thinking can override hunger cues and lead to patterns of overeating, undereating, or emotional eating, especially if you're already overweight. It has emotional and environmental triggers, and there are some common culprits: boredom, fatigue, guilt or shame, food advertisements, hormonal shifts, low self-esteem, restrictive dieting, smelling or seeing food, and stress or anxiety. And it doesn't have to do with willpower. Food noise can actually be tied to stress response and emotional regulation, especially in people managing anxiety, ADHD, or depression. So if you're very stressed, you're more likely to have food noise. And the other thing is, if you don't sleep enough or you have poor quality sleep, you're more likely to have food noise. The thing is, one of the things that we don't seem to be talking about in terms of all this diet, weight, GLP, and all this stuff, is the fact that we are wired to search for food. That food, back when, before there were supermarkets and convenience stores and food was available for everyone, before that happened, we were hunter-gatherers. And so it was very motivating to look for food. I mean, when you see animals out there, they're looking for a couple things. They're looking for food and sex and then a place to sleep. That's basically what they do. You know, when you see the birds outside, they're singing to each other. They're looking for a mate, and they're laying out territory for their mate, or they're eating. They're looking for food, or they're eating, or they're making a nest and they're reproducing. There's not much more to life than that. And so when we were hunter-gatherers, we were very motivated to look for food. And so that's still true now. And we are in an environment of food abundance. And the cheapest food is the most calorigenic, and it's the most, it's food that's easiest to have you gain weight from. So it's very easy to become overweight if you have a tendency that way. And you can be very disciplined, but if the food that's available to you is obesogenic, you're going to be more likely to gain weight. It's just very easy to do. And it was normal for people when in the hunter-gatherer times to be very active, that, you know, you didn't like do formal exercise. You did NEAT, which is non-exercise activity training. You just walked around looking for food. You walked around building your shelter. You walked around looking for water. You walked around to hang out with your mate. You cared for your children. That's all there was. So you didn't think about whether a thing had a lot too many calories and whether you shouldn't eat and whether or not you were fat. That's just not something you thought about. So in this highly evolved society we think about things that we didn't used to have to think about: how big or small we are, how muscular or not we are. And there are fashion trends. There's ways you're supposed to look or not look. Things we never used to think about when we were hunter-gatherers. So now it is difficult to be thin. And so what is rare is, but this is still true. This is stuff I used to talk about 20, 30, 40 years ago. What is rare is prized. So in this food climate, it's difficult to be thin. And who gets to take those GLP drugs? People with money. People who have less money, unless they have good insurance, don't get to take those drugs. There's a lot of support, the more money you have in this culture, to be able to be thin. And the richer you are, the less likely you are to be overweight. Not that you can be overweight if you're, that you can't be overweight if you're wealthy, but it's easier to find ways to not be overweight. You generally have less stress. You don't have to work as much. People who are middle class or lower class in terms of finance or socioeconomic stuff, they have a harder time maintaining a healthy weight because they're under a lot of stress. And stress is a huge driver of toxic eating, and it's a huge driver of raised cortisol, which puts sugar into your blood, which causes you to store fat in your middle. The more stressed you are, the more weight you're going to gain. And people who are lower socioeconomically, which is 99% of this country, are going to have a more difficult time with that. Now, if you have good insurance, you can get these GLP-1 drugs. And GLP-1 drugs turn off food noise. That's one of the big things that they do. So one of the things they do is they turn off, they calm hunger signals. People on the GLP-1s, they don't feel like eating as much. They go out to dinner and they can eat a few bites and that's it. And that's part of how they lose weight. So, I mean, if you can train yourself to eat that way without taking the GLP-1 drugs, you might be able to lose weight. And I say might because there are so many other factors. So hunger versus food noise. So when you're hungry, you have physical cues, your stomach growls, your energy is low, you're cranky, and it builds gradually and it's better after you eat, and hunger signals a physiological need. But food noise is constant intrusive food thoughts regardless of when you last ate. It feels urgent, obsessive, or tied to emotion like boredom or guilt, and stems from psychological or emotional triggers. So there's a feedback loop between your stomach and your brain. And true hunger is a physical sensation, but food noise often starts in the mind and can make you feel hungry even after you've eaten. It can be a problem, especially if you think about food all the time, even during other activities, or you feel guilty or ashamed after eating, or you frequently consume food content online. You obsess over what and when to eat, and you avoid social events due to food worries. And I would also throw in there, you go to social events because of the food that's going to be there. And there are ways to quiet food noise without taking a GLP-1. And so here are some of those ways. If you eat regular balanced meals, so I know that I have less food noise, especially if I have protein and multiple doses of protein through the day. So if I have a protein shake in the morning, I have, either turkey breast or, a tinned fish for lunch. And if I'll have some kind of protein with dinner, it's going to be either chicken or turkey or fish at dinner. And I have that throughout the day, and I pair that with vegetables and, vegetables and fruit and some whole grain, not a huge amount. I like to have oats in the morning, and then I like to lower the carbs through the rest of the day. And if I do that, I have less food noise and less need to eat more food. I also find one of those people that I think the more caffeine I have, it increases my appetite. So if I stay away from caffeine, I make better food choices and I eat better throughout the day. I think also coffee specifically irritates my stomach. So I have less coffee, my stomach works better, I have better hunger signals, and I digest better. So if you eat regular balanced meals, especially if you pay attention to your protein, you're going to have less food noise. Watch out for overly processed foods, sugar-laden foods. When you eat sugar, you raise insulin. Insulin pulls the sugar out of your blood and it drops your blood sugar too low, which makes you hungry again, which puts you in a cycle of overeating. If you're doing too much restriction, if you're restricting food because you're worried about your weight, you're restricting all the time, you're going to have more food noise. When it's not a natural state to be hungry. Well, it is natural to be hungry, but it's not natural to be hungry and then not eat. So if you're restricting because you want to lose weight and you're not, it's not that, lunchtime, you're planning to have lunch at 1, but it's 12:30 and you're kind of hungry. But at 1 o'clock, you'll get your lunch. It's normal to be hungry from that. But if you're restricting, if you're like, well, I need to eat because I'm hungry now, but I'm not going to because I'm afraid of getting fat, you're going to have food noise around that. If you practice mindful eating, where you're very appreciative of the meal that you're eating and you eat slowly and you breathe and you chew enough so that you can swallow your food properly and you get your food properly in. If you get regular exercise, you'll tend to eat better. I know that I will eat better if I get regular exercise because, quite honestly, if I'm going to go out for a bike ride, I don't want to have a big load in my stomach. If I have a lot of food in my stomach, it does not feel comfortable to ride. And then after I've done that bike ride, I'm usually not going to eat a huge, huge meal. You tend to balance out your food when you're exercising regularly. And also, as with the story that I told you about being very stressed, feeling very anxious, and then going for a bike ride and feeling so much better, when you regularly do exercise like that, you calm your stress. And that in itself will make you not want to eat as, you'll eat in a more orderly way, in a more mindful way. You need to get enough sleep. If you're awake, if you're not awake, you don't need to eat. If you're awake and say you haven't gotten enough sleep, but you're awake, so your body's going to go, oh, you're awake? Well, then you should be looking for food. And that's a hunter-gatherer thing. If you need to have energy to do your hunting and gathering, then you need to eat something. So your body's going to tell you to do that. So if you get good amounts of sleep, you're going to be spending more time sleeping, and so you're going to have less need for food because you're not awake for as many hours. And you can manage your stress through hobbies or relaxation. So if you do things that make you happy that are not food, like meditation or yoga or being in nature or doing a sport or playing a game or spending time with friends or spending time with a pet, or having sex or anything that you can do that's pleasurable, that's not eating, will help you to not have as much food noise. And then get support from a therapist or a dietitian, somebody who can help talk you through stuff. If you think you're the only one who has food noise, that's just silly. Most people in this country have food noise. How do I know? Because most people in this country are overweight. The rate of overweight in this country is at least 70%, and the rate of obesity in this country is at least 40%. I'm saying at least because that was what it was the last time I checked. It's probably higher now, and that was a couple of years ago. So the stats currently may have gone up. And so if you think you're the only person who's overweight or having this problem, you are so not. I mean, most people in the United States are overweight, and most people are not obese, but it's close. I mean, at last check, 40% of Americans were obese, but 70+% are overweight. And overweight means you have a BMI, body mass index, over 24.9. Once your BMI is 25, you're considered to be overweight. And that's a function, that's simply a function of height and weight. And yes, you can be very buff and muscular and have very low body fat and be considered to be overweight, because it's a function of weight and height. It's not a function of body mass. And so that's another reason why weighing yourself. I tell my patients the whole Fight Club thing, which is, what's the first rule of Fight Club? First rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club. What's the first rule of weight loss? Don't talk about weight loss. And why would I say that? Because thinking about weight loss, the problem with weight loss is, thank you, Jay Teta, it is neither linear, fair, nor predictable. You can do everything right this week and not lose any weight. So why focus on it? It's more important for you to get the exercise, get the rest, do the deep breathing, get the sleep, eat the healthy food, journal about it, think about your feelings, feel your feelings, do pleasurable activities. Those are all things you can do right now today. You can't lose weight today, and losing weight is not a thing that you do. Losing weight is a thing that happens as a result of what you do. So why try to control it? And instead, try to manage the things that you can manage, which is what you're eating, when you're eating it, how you're eating, whether you're enjoying it, whether you're enjoying the rest of your life, whether you're exercising, whether you're breathing, meditating, being in nature, all those good things. So, and then you can get medical options as well for a food noise. So if it's interfering with your life, you can talk to your doctor. And they, of course, can, if a physician who prescribes, can offer you GLP-1s, agonists like semaglutide, which will help reduce your appetite and quiet your food noise. They work on multiple levels. They help you feel full more easily, reduce the mental preoccupation with food. And many patients says the first time in the years they felt neutral about eating. And Carolyn Fox, who was a registered dietitian, says that when that loud food noise gets dialed down, people can finally focus on what they need to do to change their lives. It's not just about weight loss, it's about peace of mind. So GLP-1 medications aren't for everyone, but for many, they can be a life-changing tool, especially when you combine them with lifestyle and emotional support. So the thing with GLP-1, you will increase your GLP-1 by reducing stress and also by avoiding foods that make you sick. If you're eating any foods that give you indigestion, your digestive system won't work as well, and that includes your GLP-1 hormones and your GIP. So you will have better functioning GLP-1 if you eat foods that don't make you feel bad. So if you if you're drinking too much coffee and the coffee is giving you heartburn, try stopping the coffee and see if your digestive system heals. And it's amazing to me how many people drink coffee. And I mean, most people, like 90% of people in the U.S. consume caffeine, and I'm one of them. And I go on and off coffee because coffee doesn't quite agree with me. So I have to be careful with how much I drink of it. I do better with tea, and I probably do better ultimately with no caffeine at all, because I'm a slow metabolizer of caffeine. A little goes a long way. By the way, Saturday, May 2nd is National Matcha Day. So I will probably have to have some matcha on Saturday, May 2nd. And I do like my matcha, I must say. I did get some decaf matcha. Not cheap. Matcha in general is not cheap. But I will probably either get a matcha out or I'll make some matcha latte at home. So more on food noise. I just thought that this food noise concept was so interesting. So here's another article about it. It's a persistent, intrusive preoccupation with food that causes psychological distress. And they began paying attention when people said it disappeared when they took the GLP-1 medication. Can be induced by either internal or external cues, but can occur without the cues, and may have evolved as a biological alarm to seek food, just as thirst signals for you to drink water. So remember I talked about that your body, your primitive brain gets anxious when it's not sure where your next meal is coming from. And that's a survival mechanism. So if you have food noise, don't feel guilty. It's human. It's a human thing to do. And when you become confused about food, which is what happens when you have all these societal and medical cues that your body is not okay the way it is because it's too big, you're overweight, you get very confused about when and what you should be eating. And the problem with weight is you can't lose weight tomorrow. So say I have poison ivy. I have a poison ivy rash. I can get some steroid cream. I can get some grindelia, some gumweed salve. I can get some jewelweed, and I can put it on my poison ivy. My poison ivy is probably going to feel better. And in a couple of days, that poison ivy rash is going to be gone. In terms of weight, you can't like eat a couple of healthy meals and suddenly your weight is gone. It's a months and months and maybe even years long process. And so you look at yourself in the mirror and you don't fit society's expectation of what you're supposed to look like to be attractive. And you feel terrible. You look at yourself and you like, I can't do anything about this. And it's not true that you can't do anything about it, number one. And number two, that's why I encourage people to dial back on that thinking that you need to love yourself the way you are today, now. And stop worrying about what the scale says. And look at what you look like and love it. And wear clothes that feel good on you, whatever weight you're at. If you feel bad spending a lot of money on clothes, then go to the inexpensive store to get the clothes. You know, you can go to consignment shops. You can go to thrift stores. You can get a lot of deals at a lot of, local department stores. Don't worry about that. Don't wear clothes that are too tight or that make you feel bad. If you're going to get moving, which is one of the things that, like, if you want to feel healthier in your body, you need to move. You need to figure out a way to move that works for you, unless you do NEAT, non-exercise activity training. So my patients who do horses, they ride horses, they clean stalls, they take care of horses, they take care of animals. They're taking tens of thousands of steps a day. I'm not going to tell them to exercise more. So, you know, they're lifting heavy things. They're lifting horse blankets. They're getting on the horses. They're cleaning the horses. They're cleaning the stalls. That's exercise. So if you're doing stuff like that, that's your NEAT. But if you're not doing that, then you have to figure out some kind of movement that you are willing to do. And what's the best exercise for you? It's the one you'll do, whatever that is. And so I have my preferences, but those preferences may not work for you. You have to figure out what works for you. So the food noise can be induced by internal or external cues, and it can be a biological alarm, as we said. Here's a story about King Erisichthon. He was from ancient Rome. He was arrogant and contemptuous of the gods, and he was severely punished for that. He was made to experience a voracious hunger, a hurricane of starvation. All he could think about was his uncontrollable desire to procure food. In the midst of feast, he craved other feasts, and food called for food. So that's interesting. So that's how some people feel, unfortunately. And this king, unfortunately, it didn't end well for him. His insatiable preoccupation with food, that with a lot of poetic license, was a metaphor for those who experience that food noise. Human survival depends on obtaining food, which is what I said. Remember Ansel Keys? I always say Ansel Keys was wrong because I think Ansel Keys was wrong about cholesterol, that eating too much fat is what causes you to have high cholesterol. But aside from that, Ansel Keys wrote the 1,400-page book, The Biology of Starvation, and said that the history of humans is in large part the chronicle of the quest for food. Hunger or fear of it has always played a major role in determining the actions and attitudes of man. So isn't that interesting? Being afraid of, when you don't know where your next meal is coming from, that's going to cause you to feel like, oh, I'm going to go on a diet tomorrow, so I better eat a lot today because I have to eat it now. Or when you're thinking about, I really need to change my diet, that might spur on more eating because you feel like, oh, I'm going to have to stop doing this. So Ansel Keys demonstrated that 36 men who took part in a study, it was the Minnesota Starvation Experiment, they experienced symptoms of depression, irritability, nervousness, and emotional instability. They had social withdrawal, difficulty with concentration, and loss of sexual interest. Through the course of 6 months of semi-starvation, though, food and eating became their dominant concern and obsession, the most important thing. And so Kalm and Semba did research where they interviewed these men 60 years later. If you went to a movie, you weren't interested in the love scenes, but you noticed every time they ate and what they ate. So like that king, Erisichthon, the men were led by circumstances to experience extreme food noise, incessant mental chatter. So it's not clear where that term food noise came from, but the first time I heard that term, food noise, I was like, wow, that is a great term. I get it just from hearing it. You ever hear something and it's like, wow, that is well stated. That's a really good name for it. But it's taken social media by storm. Why? Because people hear that term and they go, I get it. You know, it makes so much sense. And so there's thousands of references to it in the lay press, including Scientific American, the New York Times, Weight Watchers, the Urban Dictionary, and Wikipedia now include it, although the Oxford English Dictionary doesn't have an entry for food noise yet. But that's coming, I'm sure. So it grew out of anecdotal reports from patients and their total preoccupation with food, lessening or disappearing, and uncanny mental silence regarding food when they began taking GLP-1. So it seems to have come from from people taking GLP-1s. They're like, it calmed the food noise. The GLP-1 medications affect your appetite and reward circuits of the brain for weight loss. So Duranger and colleagues in 2025 speculated that the food noise may have evolved adaptively and developed as a biological alarm to remind you to seek food, just as like thirst reminds you to seek water. So there's an emphasis of the importance of external or internal cues to elicit food noise, food cue reactivity. The smell or availability of food, physical hunger, dieting, or advertising may induce food noise, but not necessarily. So Dickus and others were the first to develop and validate a tool, which was a 5-item questionnaire to measure food noise clinically, and noted that patients describe experiencing food noise without food cues. Other researchers, like David Allison, said that who studied at Baylor, and his colleagues have begun to take food noise seriously, creating the contours of scientific legitimacy and valuing visibility for an under-recognized experience. In an attempt to codify food noise more precisely and study it methodically, Allison and others created a food noise inventory, the RAID-FN, and it's a questionnaire that assesses when thoughts of food become distressful, and found that there's a distinct psychological construct that significantly affects food choices, mental health, and quality of life. It may exist to varying degrees and can occur in the presence of specific eating disorders like binge eating. So the researchers began with 29 items and conducted 4 studies, but were able to create a 23-item scale and a shorter 7-item version of the questionnaire that was reliable and valid in the population, found that their scale did not differentiate between men and women nor correlate with a person's body mass index. And their definition focused not only on a preoccupation having a deleterious effect on well-being that may lead to dysphoria, anguish, and self-stigma, and self-recrimination because it is intrusive, it's obsessive, and incessant. And it's persistent and morphs from thoughts about food to rumination that interferes with normal cognitive functioning. So one caveat that the researchers recognize: some people indulge in diagnostic inflation and exaggerate in pursuit of a perceived advantage because they want to qualify for GLP-1 medication. So they'll tell people they have more food noise than maybe they actually have, and they present themselves as more symptomatic than they are. So food noise research remains in infancy and requires further investigation, but has clearly moved beyond anecdotal reports, and researchers will continue to measure it, and they'll be able to understand its cause, consequences, and response to treatment. So how do you deal with food noise? Are there ways to do it without taking a GLP-1 drug? Well, probably, and it's all the things you would expect. It's all the things we talk about regarding stress reduction, eating protein throughout the day, making sure you're eating healthy, balanced meals, getting regular exercise, getting regular sleep. That's what you do. And if you want to take supplements can be helpful, probably not as helpful as just eating the regular balanced meals and getting the exercise and doing the stress reduction. But if you take supplements like possibly chromium is going to help regulate your blood sugar, your glucose tolerance factor, so that you tolerate sugar better and you tend to have less sugar cravings. You're going to, if you take fish oil helps you to absorb anything into all of your cells better because it gives you healthy cell membranes and it also reduces inflammation. If you stay away from foods that inflame you, you are going to be less likely to have food noise, and you're going to be able to eat more healthfully, and you're going to get more benefit from the food that you do eat. So if you have heartburn or indigestion or some kind of digestive upset, it's well worth figuring out what foods work for you and what don't. And you've heard me talk about the big bullies, caffeine, especially coffee. It could be sugar, it could be gluten, it could be processed foods, it could be dairy, it could be eggs. Figure out what those triggers are, and if you stay away from them, your digestion will work better. And you'll have less food noise because you'll eat and you'll be more satisfied when you eat and you'll get more benefit from your food. When you are not digesting well and you're not absorbing well, you're going to be hungry. You're going to be looking for food more because you're always feeling like you're missing something. So this was a very interesting, very interesting topic. There are some studies that talk about berberine as something that enhances GLP-1. It probably does. And it doesn't work as well. It's not going to work as dramatically as the GLP-1 drugs like semaglutide and tirzepatide. But berberine has a lot of beneficial effects. It does regulate how you experience sugar in the liver. It can help to lower A1C because it regulates your insulin resistance. You tend to be less insulin resistant when you take berberine, and you tend to absorb your sugar better, and you respond to insulin better, and you produce more adequate insulin. So that's interesting. So there's other there's lots of supplements. Again, the supplements are not going to be as good as the lifestyle stuff. That's generally true. So All right. So now let's talk about, you know, Ron had surgery recently, and I wanted to talk about what supplements you can take after surgery. So let's go there. That's interesting. So when you, so this is specifically focusing on joint health and knee replacement, but after a knee replacement, so some of these are going to apply to post-surgery in general. So after you have surgery, it's a good idea to manage vitamin K intake because of its effect on blood clotting. If you're taking blood thinners, you don't want to take vitamin K because vitamin K will cause you to clot. And if there's a need for you to not clot, you need to stay away from vitamin K. Vitamin C and zinc can help you maintain a healthy immune system while you're healing from wounds. And vitamin D supports your bone health by increasing calcium absorption. So if you had surgery that was related to a bone, like a joint replacement, calcium is going to be helpful for that. Then there's anecdotal evidence about vitamin E oil for wound healing. You want to talk to a practitioner about that. I do recommend vitamin E for wound healing. As soon as your practitioner says it's okay to put stuff on your scar, for a few days, they're not going to want you to put anything on the scar. They might tell you you can take a shower, but you can't immerse yourself. I was told that from my epidural shot. No immersing for 48 hours. So the 48 hours ended yesterday. So I haven't taken a bath or gone in a pool, but I have taken showers every day since then. And so vitamin E can topically help with healing. I really am a big fan of calendula cream. So calendula is wonderful for skin health and healing, especially when it's combined with aloe and vitamin E and lavender. And then there can be some Oregon grape or berberine in there that's going to be antimicrobial. So it's really helpful for that. And comfrey is another one that I like topically. All these things, the aloe and the comfrey have allantoin in them, and allantoin is great for healthy cell differentiation and cellular growth so that you can grow healthy cells and have them not be so scarry. Mm-hmm. And vitamin E is an antioxidant, so it helps you to grow healthy tissue. So the best way to get good nutrition, wait for it, is to eat good food. So if you eat whole foods that are rich in vitamins and other nutrients, if you can't get enough of them, you could take some supplements. And there are vitamins and supplements that can help play a role in your healing, but you want to check with your doctor, of course. And some supplements can have adverse effects, of course. And if you talk to somebody who's an expert in supplements, they can help you with all that stuff. So what you want to do is avoid vitamin K right after surgery. So immediately after surgery and while taking blood thinners, you don't want to have too much vitamin K because it enhances blood clotting, which can be useful for preventing bleeding, but keeping your vitamin K amounts consistent after surgery is important because there's a higher risk of blood clots and deep vein thrombosis. So you don't want to overclot after surgery. So don't overdo your intake. So you keep it steady. So if you are used to eating a salad most days of the week, you just keep doing it. Don't increase your salads and don't all of a sudden start taking more vitamin K. Because when you have just had surgery, you're more at risk for a blood clot. And when the blood clots, it can escape and cause an embolism where it blocks some place up that you don't want it to, like a vein or an artery or your lungs. So if you use blood thinners, ask the doctor how much of the vegetables you should eat. And then vitamin C and zinc are good things to take. So vitamin C and zinc can help maintain your immune system, which is crucial for your wound healing. There's some evidence that vitamin C can help prevent inflammation and joint damage in a natural knee and also for those with knee replacement. I take vitamin C every day and I also eat fruit and vegetables. There more human trials are needed to understand if vitamin C prevents inflammation and damage. Bone health. So vitamin D is good for bone health. It plays a key role. It can help increase your bone density by promoting calcium absorption. Some foods contain vitamin D. You can also get them from supplements or from 5 to 30 minutes of sun exposure during peak daylight hours. That's going to be generally in the middle of the day. If your D levels are low in a blood test, supplementing is your best option. And so what I do for vitamin D supplementation is I test somebody's levels, and then I will recommend an amount for them to take, and then I'll test again in a few months. And so I'm often tweaking the doses so that they're in a range that I like to see. Vitamin D may help relieve joint pain in people of low levels of it. So I have patients who have very low vitamin D and they have back pain and joint pain, and then they start taking the vitamin D and it gets better. Vitamin E is helpful for wound healing. There are anecdotal reports that claim that vitamin E oil topically can aid wound healing, and research is needed to confirm those things. And you want to use your you want to talk to your doctor about when it's okay to use the vitamin E topically. You don't want to take it before surgery because it is an antiplatelet aggregator. It does cause blood thinning, and it can increase your chances of bleeding. So if you have to talk to your doctor about the particular surgery that you've had and what your window of not being able to take it is. And certainly I would say at least 5 days before, it's not a good idea to take it because it does cause blood thinning. And, you know, I'm talking to Ron about who's going to stop taking his aspirin, that he should take vitamin E because it does gently do antiplatelet aggregation. It's not as dramatic as aspirin, but it can be helpful. So it is really good for immunity and wound healing. So so when I tell people to take vitamin E orally, I tell them to take mixed tocotrienols. Those are the forms that are the least pro-oxidative in your system. And if you take synthetic vitamin E, it'll have D-L-alpha-tocopherol. The L-alpha-tocopherol doesn't work in your body. And if you have alpha-tocopherol by itself, it can cause antioxidant and pro-oxidant effects. So tocotrienols don't do that. So you want to look for a vitamin E that has tocotrienols in it. All right. Iron can be helpful for blood clotting. And if your surgeon may prescribe iron after surgery to replenish the iron that was lost during your surgery. And I also like to prescribe iron if the person is actually has anemia or has low iron. And I don't think it's enough to check somebody's hemoglobin and hematocrit to see if they're anemic. You also want to check their ferritin and serum iron levels to see if their iron is low. So that's something you can ask your doctor to do. If you go to a naturopath, the naturopath is generally going to be monitoring your iron levels. And if your iron levels are too low, you'll figure out how to get more iron on board, whether it's eating food or taking a supplement or a little of both. Then there are supplements that can help your body heal after surgery. Green tea is one of them. It has great antioxidants in it. As I said, Saturday, May 2nd, 2026 is National Matcha Day. So not just green tea, but matcha, which is just powdered green tea. Aloe vera is great. So aloe, I would tend to do topically. And again, you have to talk to your doctor about when it's okay to put topical stuff on. Curcumin is a great anti-inflammatory, and that you can eat, you can take internally, and it helps to reduce generalized inflammation. They're saying marigold here, and I think they mean calendula, because that's pot marigold, and pot marigold topically is wonderful for helping with healing. Chamomile is calming and it's going to be helpful for nerve healing. Eucalyptus and jojoba topically are going to be anti-inflammatory and antimicrobial. And then supplements that aren't necessarily herbs, like omega-3 fatty acids, can be helpful because they're going to calm inflammation and they're going to help you to make nice cell membranes as you're making new cells after having your cells breached. There are amino acids like L-lysine and arginine that can help with healing. And then MSM, methyl sulfonyl methane, which is a great anti-inflammatory, and it can be used topically as well. And you can put MSM on topically onto sore joints, and it can be helpful. And you can also take it internally, and I take it internally as well, along with glucosamine and chondroitin to help rebuild my cartilage. And there's evidence that they can reduce pain in your knee, and not clear after a knee replacement. So people can take those for different reasons, so researcher claims. So those are some supplements that can be helpful in terms of healing after surgery. You want to also make sure that you're eating, just eat good food, that you're eating adequate protein, because protein is going to help you to rebuild the tissues that have been breached, and help you rebuild muscle and joint and nerve, and anything that's been breached, you'd have to rebuild the cells. So eating adequate protein is going to be helpful for that. Eating adequate essential fatty acids, whether you take fish oil or you eat fish, is going to help you rebuild your cell membranes. Consuming foods, fruits and vegetables with vitamin C. Vitamin C helps you to rebuild collagen, and you can take collagen as well, and that's going to help you rebuild skin, skin and muscle and tissues that have been breached. So, you know, it's a good idea to talk to your somebody who's knowledgeable about supplements, about stuff that you can take after you've had any kind of surgery. So, all right. So that's the deal about surgery. So just wanted to review about how our bike riding is going. And it's unfortunate Ron isn't here to talk about it, but I'm getting better about it. And I've gone as far as so my longest ride has been 20 miles so far, which is not super far for me, but I'm thinking as long as the weather holds, tomorrow I'm going to ride more than that, a little more than that, 26 miles, and it won't be as hilly as when I did the 20 miles last weekend. Last weekend was brutally hilly. This weekend is not going to be that. And again, we're not sure if it's going to happen because it might rain, in which case I'll be getting on the trainer. But I'm looking forward to seeing what my body can do. And I've discovered too that after I ride my bike, when I ride my bike, I have to, I put compression on my knee, and I put compression on my my right knee is the one that I have more trouble with in terms of the osteoarthritis. And then I still have the nerve discomfort in the left thigh. So I put compression in both of those places and I ride with them. And while I'm on the bike, I really don't have pain. It's really great. And then I need to do aftercare. So the aftercare involves regular stretching and foam rolling. And my PT wanted me to lie on some pillows with my back arched up so that the discs that poke out during the bike ride can drain back in. And I found that I was uncomfortable lying with something up against my tummy, that it just felt uncomfortable on my tummy. So what I do instead is angry cats. So that's where you get on all fours and you arch your back like an angry cat, hold it for 10 seconds and release, and do it again for 10 seconds and release, and I do a set of 10 of those and maybe a couple of sets of those. And if I do the angry cat, I don't have anything pushing on my tummy, and I think it does help those discs to come back into where they're supposed to be. So riding my bike, I'm going to gradually increase my time, my difficulty. I rode on some nasty hills a couple of times last weekend, and I was okay afterwards, which is very exciting. And now that I've had the shot, I might be even more okay, and I'll get stronger, and I'll rebuild muscles that are weak, and then I'm hoping things will get better and better. And I do want to lose a bit of weight, because the more weight I have on, the harder that is on my spine and my back. So that's all I have to talk about today, and I have to go. And next week I'll be in Florida, so you'll hear an encore show. Anyway, it was great to share with you today. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am France Dorch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at France Dorch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thank you for listening.